just lying down on the sand dunes. I better go take a swim and see if I can cool down a little bit. 'Cause you and me, woman, we got a lot of things on our minds. I can think of a lot worse places to be, like down in the street, or down in the sewer, or even on the end of a skewer.
Thank you. Hi, it's Tori DeVito. In every family, small conversations can make a big impact. Like when my dad shared his experiences as an alcoholic.
Your honesty about that part of your life gave me a sense of integrity that I wanted to uphold in my own life.
I wanted you to know from someone who's been in recovery more than 30 years now that hard work is what creates success, not alcohol or other drugs. I said it a lot, and I'm glad you took it to heart.
Talk. They hear you. For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
RCT, the insane from way out.
You're listening to a special interview edition of Audible Sounds on 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Night Shift by Kuna Maze playing beneath me. Later today, I'll be sitting down with archivist Ian Nagoski from Canary Records. But first, we've got some bin tracks to get through. I'll see you in 9 minutes.
Ipanema to the world. Brazilian music is arguably the number one export product from Brazil. From Ipanema to the world presents Brazilian music and information to the listeners of WRCT every Friday at 7 p.m. Join in and enjoy listening to an adventurous mix of familiar standards and lesser-known gems from the Brazilian songbook in a broad range of musical styles.
I'm top dog, and I like to swim in the dark. And if you know the movie Wild at Heart, be like the girl the mom that hide, at heart. I'm always happy because
Rhythms. A Waking Nightmare, Sundays at 3 p.m.
Этот город не получит посмирения. Мы будем молиться богам, но не тем, что на небе, а тем, что упали к ногам. Так не могу, черный дождь, черная дождь, и пусть я все равно бегу, бегу. Богам, но не тем, что на небе, а тем, что упали к ногам. Жить ради дождя, ради тепла, ради света на воде. Ради тебя, ради меня, ждать предрассветного луча. Ради весны, ради любви, ради песни соловья, ради тебя, ради меня, ради нашего. Хочу домой, как хочу к тебе, чтобы пело сердце полное гнезд. Жить ради дождя, ради тепла, ради света на воде. Ради тебя, ради меня, ждать предрассветного луча. Ради весны, ради любви, ради песни соловья. Ради тебя, ради меня, ради нашего. По стенам лица дождь, я думаю, не мой дождь, я думаю, когда ты здесь, я думаю, я все еще есть.
You're listening to Audible Sounds, and if you're joining us late, today is the first installment in our Audible interview series with Ian Nagoski from Canary Records. At the top of the show, we had Night Shift by Kuna Maze, followed by Magdalena Bay with Top Dog. Finally, that was Keter Levinsky with Stop This Way. We'll get to my interview with Ian in just a second. But first, WRCT is supported by Row House Cinema. Row House Cinema is a single-screen theater in the historic Lawrenceville neighborhood of Pittsburgh. Each week, they choose a new movie theme ranging from classic, cult, foreign, animation, fantasy, and more. Their concessions feature natural popcorn with real butter, craft beer, and adjoining bottle shop, and vegan options. Row House Cinema is located at 4115 Butler Street in Lawrenceville. For more information, visit their website at rowhousecinema.com or call 412-904-3225. If you are interested in underwriting for WRCT, you can email pr@wrct.org for more information about promotional exchanges and other partnership opportunities. And now, without any further stalling for time, I present to you my interview with Canary Records' Ian Nagoski. Editor's note, this conversation took place over Zoom, so for whatever reason, my microphone came out sounding muffled. Ian's mic, however, as well as all the music he brought, still sounds great. So here's Ian Nagoski from Canary Records. Enjoy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to this very special edition of our Audible Sounds interview. This is the first ever interview we've ever done in the series, and we're here with Ian Nagoski from Canary Records. Hi, Ian. Thank you for sitting down with us.
Of course. Thanks for having me. How you doing?
I'm good. So on our show, we like to showcase some eclectic sounds. We like to showcase the weird and the worldly. And I think if there's any entity that embodies that spirit, I think it's Canary Records. So for the uninitiated, can you explain a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Well, for about 25 years, I've been digging around in musty, crusty, dusty old 78 RPM records and basements and attics and yard sales and flea markets and record stores and whatever. And for, well, since 2007, I started reissuing stuff that I turned up that began to learn some stories about. And then, since 2009, 10, 11, I had started putting out a series of LPs where I told single stories more in depth. And then over the past, I don't know, 10 years or so, I've been putting stuff out on Bandcamp. And lately it's been at an alarming rate of an album a month for 3 or 4 years. So
yeah, very prolific label.
Gathering material and telling stories from it. Stuff that mostly is left behind and isn't particularly fashionable or something, but and largely music and languages other than English has been my particular area of interest.
You brought a few tracks with you, the most contemporary of which is from 1949, is that correct?
Yeah, that seems about right. I'm not entirely clear on the date of it, but it's a it's a record I literally just turned up 10 days ago or something in Pittsburgh. In an attic and put out on a compilation record that at the time of this recording came out 9 hours ago, I think it was.
Very nice.
And it's a Hawaiian record, which is, it was made in Hawaii, pressed in Hawaii, in the English language, but by a Hawaiian woman whose stage name was Naughty Abby. Naughty Abby was from a place called Libbyville, on Oahu. Libbyville was just, it's gone now, because it was just a town that was owned by the Libby Fruit Company. I don't know, when it says Libby's, Libby's, Libby's on the label, you're gonna love it on your table, was the ad that I grew up listening to on the TV. And, you know, they were pineapple canners. So, you know, canned pineapple and pineapple juice. Anyway, so her family were all workers in the pineapple cannery. This song she didn't write, but refers explicitly to how much it sucked working at a pineapple cannery, and how exploited people were, and how people at the time were wishing to become a state of the United States. In fact, the record was released on a label called 49th State Records. In 1959, Hawaii became the 50th state. So the eponymous wish of the label itself didn't really come true.
But and made anyway. the label inaccurate.
Right, exactly. And the label went out of business right about that time anyway. So, anyway,
yeah, apropos.
They put out a lot of really good records very fast. I mean, 20 records a month for 10 years or something.
So you found this in Pittsburgh. I had missed you at the government center. Have you done anything like this in the past here in Pittsburgh? Because I was actually super bummed when I missed you, because we don't really typically get lectures like this.
Yeah, I've been to Pittsburgh lots of times. My oldest and dearest friend is there. And I've wound up coming and speaking at Carnegie Mellon, St. John's Croatian Church, the Center for Postnatural History, a bunch of places. So I usually make it out once every year or two. I love Pittsburgh and would live there if I could.
Nice.
Yeah, you're very lucky living there that it is a place where there remains enormous amounts of immigrant culture from the late 19th, early 20th century, which not everywhere in America has. And you've got a lot of vibrant music that remains from that period, which is really special. And, you know, it's you're very fortunate for that. To have that and money in the city at the same time. Unbelievable.
Definitely. Yeah, well, we can have a whole talk about where the money, where it goes and where it's spent out.
Yes, it is concentrated in the military-industrial complex, I think we can say. But anyway, yeah.
Shall we take a listen to Naughty Abby?
Anyway, yeah, Naughty Abby, it's Fish and Poi. It's a really simple song, almost dumb, but it's so clever and sweet and honest and real, the way she... Yeah, it's, I'm very fond of this record immediately, and it's such an earworm that I've been walking around singing it to myself for the past week or two.
All right, well, here's Fish and Poi by Naughty Abby.
Mama, don't scold me. I know go work today. Down there in Evelay, in the pineapple cannery. Mama, don't scold me. I bring a lay for you. I sing all day for you the songs of Hawaii. Fish and pie, fish and pie. All I need is fish and pie. Sunshine free, Waikiki. No care tomorrow. Sister Belle, dress up swell. Dance the hula in the big hotel. Shake this way, shake that way. No care tomorrow. Mama, don't scold her. Someday she catch a boy. She bring him fish and poi at the pineapple cannery. Mama, no feel bad. Someday I sure make good. Hawaii get statehood. Me president, maybe. Fish and poi, all I need is fish and poi. Need no more from the store, no care tomorrow. Fish and poi, all day long is fish and poi. Big old pool, no boo-hoo. No care tomorrow.
All right, and that was Fish and Poi by Naughty Abby. That's such a fascinating snapshot of history for me, because the whole line about bringing fish and poi to her future husband at the canning factory.
Yeah.
And then the line about statehood and then being president one day. And
right.
this is before Hawaii was even a state.
Right, it was a territory, and the monarchy of Hawaii had only just been overthrown less than 50 years earlier by agents supported by the United States government, for which the U.S. government, Bill Clinton, formally apologized in 1993. So it's loaded with some political commentary and a lot of history inside of this, like, nursery rhyme, little sweet country song, you know?
Yes, it's very much so.
It's just kind of adorable, you know? And these are the kinds of things you turn up when you go looking around and picking up random things. You just don't know what they are, putting the needle on them and listening to them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of great stuff out there.
Can I ask you, how did you get your start doing this specifically? Is it just being an audiophile? What was the first record that made you take a deeper look at things like this?
Well, I'd always been a record person since I was 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, something like that. I'd been accumulating cassettes en masse as a kid and studying the musicians I was interested in the 80s. And I guess I was in my late teens, 17, 18 years old, when one day, I spent a lot of time in thrift stores and flea markets when I was a kid growing up. We were broke, and my dad was an art history major who didn't want to work but wanted to have nice things. So he would use his eye...
Don't we all? Yeah.
Right, yeah, you know. So he thought that just by using his eye, his particular sensibility, he could look at junk and find stuff that rich people had thrown away that other people wouldn't notice. So he filled up our house full of the cast-offs of rich folks that he bought for almost no money. Anyway, so that's why I grew up in these situations. And one day I was at a flea market in Newcastle, Delaware, near where I grew up, and a guy had boxes and boxes and boxes of 78s laid out in the sun in milk crates, and I just started digging through them. I looked at every single one. I had the time, I had the interest, and I just looked at the labels, all of them, and I picked out three out of all those hundreds that day. One was a Japanese record that had been made in Hawaii in the 1930s, as a matter of fact, which turned out to be a waltz time 12-bar blues, which had a lyric sheet included in it and said that it was a song about missing home, about yearning for home and being forced to go away. A song about, you know, being in Korea. A song of Ariane. So anyway, that was 10 cents. And then there was a song by the Jewish equivalent of the Andrews sisters, who were called the Bagelman sisters. It was in Yiddish, and I had no idea what it was, and sort of went like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then there was a record by the Carter family, the Cowboy's Lonesome Song to His Herd, on Montgomery Ward Records. And anyway, they were 10 cents a piece. Took him up to the guy, and he looked at him and said, Bagelman sisters, you going to listen to that? I said, yes, I am. I bought a little classroom record player for 10 bucks, a Caliphone record player, and took him home, listened to him, went like, I have no idea what this is that I'm listening to. This is really interesting. I don't think I know anybody who knows what these records are. All of my teachers, everybody in my family, you know, anybody who thinks they're smart doesn't know what these are in my life. So that kind of gives me a thing to learn about and a thing that's special and a new way of looking at the world. And I just started making it a habit that whenever I would see records in languages other than English, I just made a rule for myself that if they were cheap, I would just buy it.
We'll be back with my guest, Ian Nagoski, after this break.
Email from school. About the incident today.
Scary.
Tell me about it. Did you have any idea that was going on?
None. I mean, you saw Derek at the game last night, too. Did you have a clue?
No. But you know, teachers like me, parents, we don't always know as much as you guys do. Kids hear first about what's going on with other kids.
Half the time, it's rumors.
It can be hard to tell sometimes, but if you're ever concerned about a friend who's having trouble with alcohol, prescription drugs, bullying, violence, anything, you need to tell an adult. Mom or me, a teacher, coach, school counselor, someone you know and trust.
Dad, no kid is gonna tell an adult about that kind of stuff.
I get it, but if we don't know, we can't help. Speaking up about a problem, that's what helping a friend is all about.
For more information, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
So you'd be driving along, there's a yard sale, there's a box of 78s, they're all in Russian. You ask, how much for the box? $5. You buy the box, take them home, listen to them. And they're mostly not going to be very good. They're mostly bad. Most records are bad. they're not, they don't have the thing you want immediately. Let's put it that way. Or they're made by people who are show-offs or trying to get famous or trying to get, you know, recognition, all those motivations people have for making music. But once in a while you put a needle on one and you realize whoever made this record really has something to say and is really trying to get across something about their life and something about the way they see the world. And you can hear that in their voice. And that's what I began to live for, was, you know, how much of that can I get my hands on? So, I started accumulating records, and now it's been 25 years listening. I don't keep a lot of stuff, but I sure do love listening to them.
Nice. So that's actually a really lovely transition into the next song. Is it Zabele Panosian? Is that how you say that?
Zabel Panosian.
actually a song we featured on my show because it's actually the first thing I ever bought on Bandcamp.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I had been a Bandcamp lurker for a handful of years just for to get free music because I was a young bum with no money. But this was featured on the Bandcamp Daily Recommended. And I don't know why, but it was just so, it stood out to me and I listened to it from start to finish. And that was the thing that made me make a purchase on Bandcamp. And then I started purchasing all my music there. So I guess thank you for that one.
All right. Well, I'm glad that worked out then. It has been a hit. It has been a record that I've seen a lot of people react to. And, it's a record that matters to me enormously, over time. And it's a record that I encountered cold, kind of like you did, as a matter of fact. I'll tell you the story of how I first heard it, which is that I got interested in recordings in particular made by immigrants to the U.S. from what had been the Ottoman Empire. Records made in the U.S. in the 19-teens, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, in Turkish, Greek, Arabic, Armenian. And I met a guy, was introduced to a guy named Leo Sarkisian about 10 years ago, who was 93 years old at the time. And Leo was getting rid of some of his stuff. He was just retiring as a broadcaster, had been hired in 1963 by Edward R. Murrow at The Voice of America, and was just retiring, 93 years old. And Leo knew that I cared about the music. And he said, do you want the 78s? And I said, I would really love that. Thank you. He gave me his records, and I took them home, and I listened to them. And one of them was an orange label Columbia that was cracked. And when I put the needle on it, the first thing I heard was piano and strings, which was a bummer, because that's not what you want when you put a needle on a record. You don't want middle class aspiring music and values. You know, you want the inherited aesthetic among 78 collectors is you want down-home, funky, real, like authentic music, right? This is like through the filter of like middle class value. Not really what I wanted. But then her voice starts and I go, oh wow, that's pretty. Well, you can really sing. I like you. Okay, good. And then she does this thing with her voice and it just nailed me to the wall. Could not believe it. And just felt like I was suspended in time and space. And the record ends, I picked up the needle, and I put it back down at the beginning, and it did it again. It just killed me. And I thought, okay, now I need to know everything about you, right? I was working on a project at the time about this immigrant group and their listenership in the U.S., and I included this record on it in 2011. And at the time, I came up with two sentences of biography about the woman who made it. It was in her mid-20s and a mother about the time she made it, 1917. And then I got contacted by a couple of guys over the years, Harry Kazelian and Harut Arakelian. Harry's in Michigan. Harut's in L.A. area, Southern California. And they were interested in what I was doing with this stuff. And they started doing research, and we started sharing research back and forth and back and forth, to the point that ultimately, last year we were able to publish an entire book about Zabel and her life. Really been able to make her stand up and walk around among us, and she's become so important to us. And we found out that multiple takes of her little tiny discography circulate. So she only recorded 11 songs in about a year and a half. 1917, 1918, we've turned up 26 separate takes that circulate. So, yeah, when you bought the Zabel record, I don't know how many tracks there were on it, maybe only six or something, when I first launched it. I've probably added 20 more tracks since whatever that was, 2016 or something. The price has gone up a little bit, too. I think it was originally $2, and I think now it's $7, so... I love Zabel Pinozzi.
What is it about her that's so compelling to you?
One of the things that I think is going on with her is that she, at the time, was learning to hear in two ways. She was from a town of 10,000 people in present-day northern Turkey, a place called Bardizag, about 80 miles due east from Istanbul, Constantinople. And what she's singing is a very, very old song. It was already 300 years old when she recorded it. It's a song that lots of people know. Her version of it, her melody, is specific to the region where she grew up. It is the song that she learned from her people in her town and carried with her to the United States. And really, only she, as one other guy, much later, recorded this particular melody to these words, these very, very old words. Now, she comes to the U.S., and the U.S. is in the grips of opera mania in 1907, 8, 9, 10, when she's fresh off the boat. I mean, that was the height of class and sophistication and fame and glamour, exactly what Hollywood became in the 1930s and 40s, 50s. All of that thing that people aspire to, of being the center of attention and being loved by a public, that's what an opera star was in 1905, 10, 15.
They were the pop stars and rock stars of their time.
They were certainly the most celebrated and best paid performers in the world. So anyway, she goes to this brand new Boston Opera Company and sees this stuff. Now, she's already a singer. She likes singing, sang in church, all this stuff. But she falls in love with this music, the grand opera, and gets herself vocal lessons, gets trained in the U.S. by a woman named Gertrude Duena in Boston, and then begins synthesizing the music from her home with this grand opera tradition, coloratura style that was happening at the time in opera. And she develops something specific to her that is very political. I mean, it's reacting immediately to what's going on at home, which is the genocide. When she records this song, her town where she grew up, 10,000 people, was entirely drained of its population, and everyone died, and everything was gone.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. In 1915, her town had 10,000 people. In 1918, it had 36 people.
Oh.
Everyone. The town was destroyed. Everyone was put on a train to another train to another train, and then marched into the Syrian desert, where 1.5 million people died of thirst and starvation and exposure, including her father, who had saved her life by sending her to the United States.
No kidding.
So, that's what the song is really about. It is a reaction to the horror of knowing that everything back home is gone, and there's no home to go back to. And that's the situation that Armenians in the United States found themselves in, right at this time, 1917. So it was a huge hit. It sold like crazy. It went through at least 7 different pressings, and stayed in print until 1931, when Columbia Records finally deleted its Armenian language catalog. It's an extraordinary record. And what's amazing is that she had been so completely forgotten. She was the voice of a generation. She and another guy, a tenor who she worked with sometimes, named Armanag Shamaradian. Shamaradian was somewhat remembered. Zabel was not. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but God, it's such a good record.
Fascinating. All right, but let's transition to something a little lighter. I wanted to talk about Charles Kellogg and the Bird Chorus.
Charles Kellogg is somebody who I'm also doing a lot of reading and research about. I'm fascinated by Kellogg. He's somebody else that I really love. Other side of the coin from Zabel and all the sadness and everything. Mm-hmm. Kellogg was an extraordinary performer in the history of American stage. Should I tell you the biography, the backstory on Kellogg?
Oh, please.
Yeah. Okay. So the deal with Kellogg is that he was born in the middle of the 19th century in a town in the Sierra Nevada mountains that was a gold mining town. His father sold provisions to gold miners in Northern California there. And his mother left the family when he was about 3. And he spent several years of his childhood out in the woods by himself, basically. Hanging out, looking at the animals and the trees and stuff. And he learned to do a thing while he was out there as a little kid, which was to imitate the animals, to talk back to them by using his throat, by forcing air up through his throat and out through his nose and mouth. So he could imitate birds, not by whistling with your, like, the way you whistle with your lips puckered, but actually by blowing air through his nose with his mouth closed. It was a funny thing. Anyway, his father got a little bit worried about him being out in the woods all the time and sent him off to school in Syracuse to live with family. He graduates college and becomes like a kind of proper Yankee, really. Learns to build fireplaces and do woodworking and that kind of handy masculine stuff. But, you know, he's a college boy. And right out of college, he starts doing performances in a circuit, what's called a Chautauqua, which is like it was like the upper class version of vaudeville, where people would do sort of like edutainment. You know, people would feel good about themselves, like listening to one of these, like, you know, fancy podcasts or, you know, the kind of thing where you're pleased with yourself for learning something, right? So
I was going to say, who would possibly be smart enough to...
A little bit like this, maybe. Right. Yeah, I know. But Kellogg gets up on stage and he does this thing he learned how to do as a kid where he imitates birds with his mouth closed, and it blows people's minds, and he realizes he's got a career. He's got a job. So for the next 50 years of his life, he spends several months a year on tour, going around doing this in public, and it had a line of patter. He had a rap, he had a stage show that went with it. Like me, he was a guy who could talk and talk and talk. His shows were very often, you know, an hour, 2 hours long. But he would come out dressed as a woodsman and give you this whole spiel about it's a core set of things that he loved. He loved the woods, nature. He loved love itself and vibration and fire. And he believed that there was an interconnectedness of all beings on Earth and that it was vibration that brought us all together. He had acquired, apparently, an early edition in English of Hermann Helmholtz's On the Sensations of Tone, physics book about acoustics, that demonstrated that air is not empty space. It is, in fact, a medium that operates more or less like water, and that vibrations flow through it and sound flows through it. So he would do these demonstrations with what he called a blade of flame, a Bunsen by gas burner, with a big, long, 4-foot blue flame in a glass tube, and he would make it dance. He would make it do little spirals, and he would extinguish it using this vocal technique that he had developed. He said he had a 10.5 octave vocal range, more than a grand piano. No. He also said that he actually had a bird's syrinx, not a human larynx. He said that doctors had examined it. He was, in other words...
He would claim to have different anatomy than your typical
another
singer?
Another human being, right, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That he had been born with this physical anomaly that allowed him to sing, which is nonsense, complete malarkey, you know. Absolutely gibberish.
Birds sing not with vocal cords, but with a series of half rings in the throat called a syrinx. I was born with the gift of singing as a bird, and the scientists have discovered that the reason for this is in the formation of my throat, which is identical with that of the bird. The lark, the thrush, the nightingale, all singing birds have many rings or half rings in the throat and can sing many songs. Such and all fowl have but two half-brains, and so can only produce a squawk.
But, it was part of his shtick for years and years and years that he literally had a bird's throat, right? So, anyway.
So, you compare this gentleman to, say, like an early version of a TED Talk, and then you also claim that he was not also 100% factual.
He is a kind of combination of Walt Whitman and P.T. Barnum at the same time. With maybe some, like, Mark Twain thrown in there. He's a complicated and fascinating person who did a lot of things.
When I heard this track, I did not immediately realize it was a person. I actually thought it was a bunch of field recordings.
Ah. So, there's another thing you didn't realize about it.
Yes.
Now, he makes these records in the 19-teens. They're basically divided into two categories. One is like a pop song, like a light classical kind of ditty, where he does the bird imitation over top as if the bird is singing the melody, right? So that's kind of charming, and, you know, those records are very common. There's another group of his records that are his stage act, where he talks and does demonstrations. There are lots of those. They're all wonderful. These are all very common records, by the way. And then there's this one. This one is peculiar. It is, in fact, the last record he made, 1919. And what it is an extension of a part of his stage act that he developed where he would go to a town, he would borrow 6 or 7 Victrolas from a local store, and he would have with him pressings of himself doing bird imitations, and he would start playing all of them and then do it along so that you would get the effect of, he said, you know, being in a forest and surrounded by bird songs. You know, this overwhelming bird song thing. 1919, he goes into the recording studio at Victor Records in Camden, New Jersey. He makes a record of himself doing a bird imitation thing, very carefully planned, plays that record back while he does another very carefully planned take of himself.
Interesting.
Bird imitation. It is, in fact, the first ever instance of overdubbing made on a record.
That's the earliest example of overdubbing, is a gentleman pretending to be several birds?
Yes. Charles Kellogg invented overdubbing on record in 1919, decades before Les Paul.
That's fantastic.
And that's what this record is. It is Charles Kellogg doing two takes of bird imitation that are so carefully planned and densely woven that you really can't tell how many takes there are or how, you know, how it would have even occurred. But no one would know that looking at the label and putting the needle on it. It takes all of this reading about the context of Kellogg and his life and stuff in order to come to this conclusion. I'm delighted by it. And it's a wonderful performance. The more I listen to it, the more I'm amazed at his skill. There were lots of bird imitators during the early 20th century. It was a genre. It was a thing. Which I'm interested in, generally. But Kellogg, I mean, there's just nobody like him. He's just the best. In a league of his own.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to my interview with Ian Nagoski from Canary Records. Later in the interview, Ian and I got on the subject of Greek music, particularly of that of George Kastaros.
Oh, and Mantus Hashden, the name of the song. Yeah, that's the kind of thing that he got famous for started recording in the U.S. in the late 20s and recorded for about 20 years. He's best remembered as an exponent of what's referred to as rebetika, just like this underworld music of dope smokers and demi-criminals and sort of tough, stylish guys in Athens at the time. He was not from Athens. He didn't go to Athens until he was way old, like in his 90s. He was celebrated and brought over as a great kind of cultural figure of the Greek people. But that's partially because he lied about himself so relentlessly, it turns out. In fact, he claimed to be 10 years older than he was. He claimed to be from an island. He was not. He was from the northern part of the country, Thessaly. He made all kinds of claims later in life about who he was and what he'd done. He said he toured you know, all of Africa and Australia and all these places. He never did any of that. It's nonsense.
He did a lot into that, those 10 years he gave himself.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's not 100% clear why he lied so much, except one thing I know for sure is that he had a family. He had a wife and several kids whom he abandoned in the late 40s, early 50s, went to Boston, worked in a nightclub there, a belly dance club, made a lot of money, was certainly involved in some, like, gangster mobster types, were part of the scene in these clubs.
That's so fascinating, because you wouldn't listen to this and think, wow, this is gangster music at the time. These are what all the kind of macho aspiring would-be gangsters would be making or listening to.
Παίξε τη διπλό παινιά σου, να φαρείς τη καρδιά σου. Παίξε τη διπλό παινιά σου, να φαρείς τη καρδιά σου. Για σου βρε μαν το μου τερβίσει, ποτέ και σου δεν θα σβήσει. Γέμωσε μας το λουλά σου και παίξε μας το βάκλαμά σου. Γέμωσε μας το λουλά σου και παίξε μας το βάκλαμά σου.
It's kind of that sort of thing. It is a first-person account of actually hanging out at what it was called a teke, which was a hash den. It was a place where people go smoke dope, which was, you know, along with gambling and hanging out with belly dancers and stuff. That was very much part of Katsaros' life. That's what he liked doing and was good at. You know, he had the style. He had this, like, really great sort of shock of kinky hair that he was very proud of his whole life. But he had really, he was a great songwriter. I mean, really, like, Jimmy Rogers, Hank Williams level songwriter, which is a new thing in music during the 1920s. People are still very much playing folk music that is compiled from different floating verses. You know, they're just patching verses. He's really writing whole songs all the way through, which is a new thing, and rather American. And he plays a Martin guitar, not a Greek instrument. It's made in Nazareth, Pennsylvania, you know. Tours around as a very good guitar player. You can hear he taught himself this particular, very personal technique. I'm very fond of him, and I'm very... There's this kind of whole legend around him, and the fact that when you go looking back at the newspapers and read about his life and looking at the documentation that survives of who he was and where he was from, again, you know, I'm kind of fascinated by it. I'm a little bit like Charles Kellogg is auto-mythologizing, because the fact that he's such a liar. The way that Katsaros is remembered among Greeks is, yes, partially due to the fact that they, you know, he claimed to be 109 years old when he died, but he was actually 99, which is significant.
But that's still pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Interesting that he was lying up until his last days at 99.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it has partially to do with that. It has partially to do with all these stories he told about himself that people believed because they wanted to, because they have such good stories. There's a kind of, he survives as an idea among Greeks, but he does not survive so much in, you know, popular, I would say, American culture, which has to do with the problem of immigrant musicians in the United States. We have consistently neglected the creative work of immigrants to the U.S. over and over and over again. If it's not in the English language, it's as if it doesn't count, right?
Mm-hmm.
clearly Casaros is as good a musician as the Carter family, or, you know, any of the stuff that would be the basis of what's called Americana, right? Jazz, blues, country, gospel, all that stuff that, you know, the Bob Dylan stream of culture, right? He's clearly right there at the time doing work that's just as good and amazing if you kind of have a sense of the words and the context. And yet, you know, we let it go because it's not in English. And that's America demands assimilation among immigrants. And we leave behind so much great stuff just on the basis of not being American enough, not being enculturated enough in the monocultural version of America. So, anyway, that's something that I am deeply concerned with as a person who goes digging around old records. You know, I see constantly abandoned lots of great stories and musicians simply for the fact of having been immigrants. If they had stayed in their own countries and been able to make records there, they might be, you know, these big celebrated figures. But they came here where their legacy would not be appreciated. And on the other hand, by reintroducing this material to the culture, maybe it will help America understand something of what we've neglected or lost. And maybe it will help the language groups, the ethnicities of these people, to rediscover some things that, you know, they might be interested in, that might have lasting value for them, even if it comes through somebody who is an outsider. So,
I have one final question. Are there any other kind of archival sources, any other records or historians or collectors that you would, for the curious, that you would like to, you would suggest to anybody?
There's so much that I'm grateful to have learned from people who have been involved in similar process and other people who are, you know, doing similar projects. Right off the top of my head, there's a guy in Los Angeles named Jonathan Ward, who's a very serious archivist in a way that I have never been and never will be, who has had a blog called Excavated Shellac for more than a decade, which is wonderful. He is extremely knowledgeable and has a great ear. He's just got it, man. So he put out a big box set on Dusted Digital, I think last year or the year before, of his work. So yeah, Excavated Shellac is amazing. There was a guy who's a generation older than me named Dick Spotswood, who did an enormous amount of work researching through the 70s, 80s, 90s. He's still alive in Florida, still working very active as a researcher, who really was the person that made it possible for people like me to look seriously at immigrant music in the United States during the period kind of 1895 to 1942. I mean, he was influenced by Pekka Grano in Finland, but anyway, he really kind of opened the doors. You know, he did dozens, hundreds of reissue records, all kinds of stuff, like a big bluegrass guy for one thing, but then also tons of, you know, great recordings of Ukrainian stuff, and tons of Chinese records, and Middle Eastern stuff. And, he published this giant discography, this set of books that actually gives catalog number, matrix number, title, artist, recording dates for a significant amount of the material recorded in languages other than English in the United States in the early 20th century, which is a real roadmap for me and lots of other people about, like, what's out there. It's a way that we can look at a kind of data set and figure out, you know, what in the world's going on. So, very grateful to him, of course, and you know, lots and lots and lots of people. Chris Strawitz just died, who ran our Hooli Records, who was an immigrant to this country and fell in love with down-home folk music of all different kinds, but in particular recordings made in the Spanish language, of which there are hundreds of thousands, which he systemically collected and wound up donating, and a lot of that stuff is available on YouTube as part of the Frontera collection. Wonderful material. And, you know, I'm at 48 years old. I'm just beginning to just scratch the surface of any of that stuff. You know, it's a wonderful deep well. So, there's a few.
Awesome. Thank you for plumbing the depths with me, Ian.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
So, thank you so much for being on the show. It means a lot to me, and keep doing what you're doing.
Hey, thanks a lot. It's been really fun talking to you.
And that was my interview with Ian Nagoski. Thank you again to Ian for coming on the show and sharing all of your knowledge and passion with us today. All the tracks we covered can be found at Canary Records on Bandcamp, as well as all the music that was playing in the background. Our tracks covered today have been Fish and Poi by Naughty Abby, Grounge by Zabel Panosian, Bird Chorus by Charles Kellogg, and Manthu's Hashden by George Castoros. Thank you all so much for listening to this Audible interview. If you are interested in listening to the extended interview with Ian, you can find it on YouTube. Just type Audible Sounds into the search bar. It should be the first thing you find. Audible is spelled like Odd Future. That's O-D-D-I-B-L-E Sounds. Alternatively, you could also find it on my personal Instagram profile at This Is Audible. For Audible Sounds, I've been John Hartwell. I'll see you all on the next one.
You're listening to Sick on WRCT Pittsburgh.